Explore 16,000 years of Virginia history. The Virginia Museum of History and Culture offers a variety of exhibitions, public programs, and special events for the whole family. Learn more and plan your visit at virginiahistory.org.
Welcome to Revolution Revisited, your crash course in the American Revolution. As the 250th anniversary of America's independence approaches, dive into the stories of Virginia's rebels, rule breakers, and rabble rousers who shaped a nation. This podcast is brought to you by the Virginia Museum of History and Culture and made possible by William and Karen Fralin.
Welcome back to Revolution Revisited. I'm your host, Maggie Creech. When we picture Virginia in the years leading up to the American Revolution, we often think of fiery speeches, political upheaval, and calls for liberty. But in Tidewater, Virginia, another story was unfolding, one about education and who had access to it. Today, we're talking about the Williamsburg Bray School. The Williamsburg Bray School operated from 1760 to 1774, teaching free and enslaved Black children in the heart of the colonial capital. It's a story that complicates our ideas about the era and the meaning of freedom. To help us explore it, we're joined by Nicole Brown.
My name is Nicole Brown, and I am a doctoral candidate in the American Studies Department at William & Mary. One of the things that I specialize in is not just studying the Williamsburg Bray School, but all Bray schools in the Atlantic world, and specifically using an interdisciplinary approach. So that means applying archaeology, material culture, and in my case, collaboration with different descendant communities of individuals who descend from the scholars of these schools to try to create a more equitable narrative and a more honest narrative about the histories of these schools that are funded by the Associates of Dr. Bray.
The term Bray Schools refers to a network of 18th century schools in colonial America focused primarily on educating Black children.
So the Bray Schools are a term that academics use to describe a cohort, a network of schools that were predominantly focused on Black education in colonial America. In the 18th century, many of them are described as Negro schools or charity schools or Negro charity schools, but ultimately all of them are funded by the Associates of Dr. Bray, who perhaps unsurprisingly are named after a man called Bray. Reverend Dr. Thomas Bray was one of the most powerful Anglican ministers in the Church of England in the 18th century. I think the best way I've ever heard Thomas Bray described is actually ironically from an academic title of an article. It's called Reverend Dr. Bray's Trip to Maryland. He was the first representative to the Bishop of London in Maryland. And the subtitle is A Study in Militant Anglican Humanitarianism. And I think that perfectly encapsulates the ideology behind all of these schools. All of them are pro-slavery in the early part of their formations. All of them are pro-slavery up until the American Revolution. And all of them take a very specific tone of using religious doctrines from the Church of England to propagate and uphold slavery through what I would call schooling endeavors.
The first Bray School was founded in Philadelphia in the late 1750s after decades of internal debate among the Bray associates about how to use funds left by Reverend Dr. Thomas Bray, who died in the 1730s. Proposals ranged from missionary schools to training white ministers in the Caribbean. Eventually, Secretary John Waring consulted Benjamin Franklin about establishing schools for Black children in urban areas. Franklin supported the idea, noting his own observations of racism in Philadelphia schools and recommending Philadelphia as the starting point. After Philadelphia, Bray schools were opened in Williamsburg, New York City, Newport, Rhode Island, and eventually Fredericksburg, Virginia. Today, we're specifically talking about the Williamsburg Bray School. It was the first Bray school in the colonial South and the longest running one there, operating from 1760 to 1774. A school was later opened in Fredericksburg, and although other Virginia locations never saw official schools, the Bray Associates sent books to local ministers, some of which were given to enslaved people. So, what did education look like in Virginia as a whole? When we place the Williamsburg Bray School in the wider context of colonial Virginia, it can challenge some of the broad assumptions we often hear, like enslaved people were never taught to read or write, or even that schooling in general was rare in the 18th century. But Nicole's research is revealing a more complicated picture in Tidewater, Virginia, where education took forms that don't always match our expectations.
Education in the 18th century is not meant necessarily to advance you forward, unless you're a Wythe or a Jefferson, perhaps. It's meant to train you for your station in life. And there is no better description that I like to use than the definition of education that comes out of the Oxford English Dictionary. And they list this as one of their standard definitions from 1531 until 1844. It states, "The process of bringing up, the manner in which a young person was brought up, with reference to social station, kinds of manners or habits acquired, calling or employment prepared for." Isn't that interesting? They don't mention anything about reading, writing. It is all about knowing your place in the world.
Education was shaped by race, class, gender, and location. Apprenticeships provided a sort of combination of work-study, think learning skills for a specific trade, and classroom education. We're talking reading and religious instruction. Importantly, apprenticeships involved a legally binding agreement and were an avenue available to both Black and white children. There were also more formal educational environments in Williamsburg. White children had a few options. Middle-class students might attend the Matthew Whaley School, while elite families could hire private tutors or pursue studies at the grammar school at William and Mary. Some Black children, both free and enslaved, attended the Bray School, while the Brafferton School of William and Mary educated boys from indigenous nations. Despite Williamsburg's small population of about 1,880 people on the eve of the American Revolution, it had a surprisingly varied educational landscape, though access to each option depended heavily on one's place in the social hierarchy.
In the 18th century, you can't seem to get a consensus from an entire population on who should be educated, why they should be educated. And this is certainly the case with Black education. So when you get to Williamsburg in the 1750s, there are ministers who are trying to infuse this idea of offering Black education to enslaved peoples. Now, this is not an altruistic mission. Well, let me rephrase that. Some of these individuals might perceive it as an altruistic mission. We are saving the souls of these enslaved individuals. But what's very clear from the publications that they use and the way and the tone that they write about this instruction is that it is meant for religious indoctrination to yield to racial ideas of control. They're using texts not only like Dixon's English Instructor or The Child's First Book. They're also using texts such as Bacon's Sermons to Slaves and Slave Owners, in which those kinds of sermons expressly state you are to believe that God meant you to be enslaved. The idea is that the education would make people more compliant. Now, in practice, is this what happens? No, absolutely not.
Don't miss your chance to see Give Me Liberty, Virginia and the Forging of a Nation at the Virginia Museum of History and Culture before it closes on January 4th. This special exhibition commemorates the 250th anniversary of the Declaration of Independence. Discover Virginia's leading role in the American Revolution and how both iconic and everyday people helped forge a new nation. Tickets at virginiahistory.org.
Hundreds of students attended the Bray School during its 14 years in operation. Let's learn some of their names.
We only have pieces of the documentary record to go on, so I'll tell you what I know based on the written record, and then I'll also expound upon it using other ways of knowing. So based on the primary sources, there are three student lists that are still extant: a student list from 1762, a student list from 1765, and a student list from 1769. And the other ultimately almost 11 years are not extant. It's not because they were necessarily not written, but we just haven't been able to locate them. So I'm ever hopeful we'll find another student list. But approximately 30 children attended the Williamsburg Bray School every year. So this means that hundreds of students were taught or went through this school throughout its 14-year duration. We have a couple of repeat students, but most of the scholars that are on these lists are new names. When you look at the students themselves, about 90% of them are enslaved and 10% are free. If you want to get more specific, 93% are enslaved and 7% are free. The Ashby family and the Jones family are the two free Black families we definitively know used the Bray School. There's another young girl named Mary Ann on the 1762 list, but we don't have a last name for her. She's just described as free. When it comes to the other students, you have, and please know, I'm going to try to say as many student names as I can, because I think it's so important to say these children's names. So in addition to John, Mary, and Harry Ashby, who attended the school, Alicia and Mary Jones and Mary Ann, who are all free Black students, you have students, for example, such as Elizabeth, who is 10 years old in 1762, and she is enslaved by a woman named Mrs. Dawson, who is the wife of the former president of William and Mary. You also have students such as Ripon, who's 3 years old. He's enslaved by Anthony Hay, who was a cabinet maker in town and also ultimately owned the Raleigh Tavern, which is a major political hub prior to the American Revolution. You have students like Aggie, Sam, and Roger, who are enslaved by Peyton Randolph, who is the Speaker of the House of Burgesses. You have students like Jack and Sal, who are enslaved by Jane Vobe, who's the keeper of the King's Arms Tavern, and also enslaved Gowan Pamphlet. So when you're looking at these student lists, it's easy to talk about broad trends, right? 93% of students were enslaved based on these lists, 7% were free, about almost a perfectly even divide between boys and girls. But it's why I also feel it's important to mention these individuals by name, because they're children, they're people, and they're not recognized as people on the student lists. That is made very clear based on how they're written, but they are people. The way we know that they are perceived as property, often more than people, is because almost all of these students that are enslaved, actually all of the students that are enslaved, are listed by their enslavers' names, not by their mothers or fathers or siblings or community members' names.
This is an important detail. The parents and family members of enslaved children held no decision-making power over their own children. Ultimately, it's the enslavers that make decisions about whether or not the children will attend the school and for how long. Bray School rules required students to attend for at least 3 years, but actual attendance varied widely, from as little as 6 months to about 2 years.
The Williamsburg Bray School trustees lament repeatedly that they cannot keep the students in the school as long as they would like because enslavers will, quote, remove them before any semblance of Christianity can be taught them, end quote. So what that also speaks to is the complexity of the economic endeavor of a Bray School. When you look at the students who come to this school, it appears their enslavers have some very clear intentions for how they expect to themselves to benefit from a scholar's instruction.
Interestingly, the longest documented span for a child was from a free Black family who appeared on school records 4 years apart, though this may not have indicated continuous enrollment. Now let's focus on what these students were learning.
So there are different types of skills being taught. And then there is, of course, the teachings of the belief of the Church of England. There is so much debate amongst academics about what is taught. I've had a lot of debates with certain scholars who argue writing could not possibly have been taught. I argue that writing was taught, and I'll explain to you why. But we know that they list off in the school rules reading, the spelling of words, which in the 18th century, according to Samuel Johnson's dictionary, means both the reading of words and the writing of words. They are also teaching stops, which is a specific form of grammar. Points and stops are two different things in the 18th century, but they often overlap. It's the verbal recitation and the written recitation of grammar. According to one of the books that is used at the Bray School, Dixon's English instructor, there's an entire section on writing, but there's also a section on orthography. And orthography is actually the copying out of other people's compositions. So you can see that writing in the 18th century is defined as one's own intellectual composition. And the Bray associates are assuming that that can't be taught. So writing doesn't mean the same thing in the 18th century as it means to us today. Writing today means just teaching writing. But in the 18th century, there's spelling, orthography, points, stops, writing, and marking, which is the sewing of the written word. So again, long story short, it gets complicated. Ultimately, though, they are teaching reading. They are teaching the spelling of words, which absolutely constitutes writing. They are teaching sewing and knitting to the girls in particular. And for anyone who's had to make a sampler before, very often that is the stitched out marking of letters and words. And the most common stitch in the 18th century used in samplers that we have that are still extant, mostly from young white girls in Williamsburg, is the marking stitch, which requires you to be able to count to 9. And the back of the sampler has to look as good as the front of the sampler. It has to be perfect on the back as well as the front. So there's a lot of geospatial reckoning. So they're likely teaching sewing skills like the marking stitch. They're teaching knitting, which absolutely requires you to have basic arithmetic. Interestingly, arithmetic is not mentioned in the school rules, but we also see from the archaeological record clay marbles being found. And clay marble games in the 18th century necessitate two things: the ability to be able to count and the ability to utilize strategy, which is interesting because the strategy part directly contradicts the Bray School rules, which are teaching control, compliance, subservience.
Though both the Bray associates and enslavers viewed the tools of education as something they could use to maintain a racial hierarchy, reality was different. These students learned to read and spell and copy, and so they gained all the foundational skills necessary to express their own ideas.
So students leave the school. Whether they're there for 6 months or 3 years, it doesn't really seem that the school is leading to the compliance that the enslavers would hope for. I'll give you an example. One of the trustees of the Williamsburg Bray School, his name was Robert Carter Nicholas. He was actually the treasurer of Virginia prior to the American Revolution. And he writes to the Bray Associates in 1765, complaining that one of the students he sent to the school, who he was possibly expecting, very likely expecting to be an enslaved domestic in his household, right? So that carries a very complex series of roles. It could be laundry, cooking, child rearing, seamstressing work, but highly, according to an enslaver, highly skilled positions. And he complains about the school not leading to her, quote, being reformed, end quote. I'm going to give you the whole phrase, quote, "I had a Negro girl in my family that was taught at the school upwards of 3 years, and she made as good a progress as most, but she turns out a sad jade, notwithstanding all we can do to reform her," end quote. What that shows you, though, is that the perceived pious reformation to lead to racial subjugation behind these schools is not working, and it's not even working in the home of the trustee for the school.
Education gave these students some agency, even if that wasn't the intention, and it didn't go unnoticed by those in power. The Bray schools in Virginia closed shortly before the Revolutionary War and did not reopen. In addition, anti-literacy laws were enacted shortly thereafter.
Laws are almost always reactive, not proactive. And so anti-literacy laws for Black peoples begin to be put on the books in Virginia, almost neatly dovetailing with one generation after the Williamsburg Bray School operated. And I think that speaks to this idea of once you have a revolution, it's a revolution of not just politics, but society, culture. And certainly the American Revolution created a watershed shift in intentions on education. And it's when education stopped being considered a religious responsibility and a human right that all of a sudden these anti-literacy laws for Black people come onto the books in Virginia.
The Williamsburg Bray School has been getting a lot more attention lately, especially after its recent move onto Colonial Williamsburg's property, where it's now a site visitors can explore. That change comes from new research, growing public interest, and closer work with the descendant communities. For a long time, the school's history wasn't widely known, in part because scholars long debated the school's original location. Victorian literature professor Terry Myers became fascinated with the school after discovering in William and Mary's archives that the college has sent two enslaved children, Adam and Fanny, there in 1769. His research eventually led him to suspect that a building known as the Diggs Building was the Williamsburg Bray School's original site. The finding was debated amongst scholars until dendrochronology testing, aka analyzing tree rings in the building structure, confirmed the identification. William and Mary and Colonial Williamsburg partnered in this work, and further details have been documented in recent articles and oral histories. In addition to the work of Colonial Williamsburg, the William and Mary Bray School Lab was created to research the school's history while actively involving the descendant community. Its work includes transcribing original correspondence, conducting oral histories, offering public and digital programming, and mentoring students in turning archival research into accessible public history. Nicole has served as one of the lab's graduate assistants.
The William & Mary Bray School Lab is an incredible partnership where they focus on not only researching the Williamsburg Bray School, but really involving the descendant community and how that research is done. There's all kinds of things that the William & Mary Bray School Lab was involved in, and I was really just sort of one segment of that as the graduate assistant. So I got to work with students in particular and mentor students, undergraduate students, in not only how to conduct research, but how to take that research and turn it into public-facing, accessible content. I will say working at the Bray School Lab was one of the best experiences of my life. And I learned so much from these students. I wrote a blog about it actually recently, if you're interested. I wrote about what I learned from descendants and students in the 3.5 years I worked there.
One of the projects Nicole worked on involved creating audio recordings of these 18th century Bray School transcriptions, an idea suggested by a descendant to make the material more accessible. Many of these recordings were voiced by women and people of color. As Nicole puts it, this offers a deliberate counterpoint to the white men who originally authored these documents. The lab's mission underscores the importance of making historical sources not just available, but truly accessible, ensuring that more voices can participate in telling the Bray School's story. Even though the Bray School story begins a bit before the American Revolution, it shares many of the same threads, questions about liberty and power and inequality that would come to define the revolutionary era.
What I think you should keep in mind or explore or question for yourself is not only what does revolution look like, but who is actually involved in revolution, as well as where do they exist? Revolution can be a major political event, like the Continental Congress in Philadelphia. Revolution can also be a child like Hannah, causing her enslaver such irritation that he chooses to write about her in a letter to a person he's never met because he is so irritated by her lack of reformation. There's big revolutions, there's small revolutions, but revolutions involve people of all races and classes. And they are not just fought on the terrain of battlefields. They are fought in the mundane spaces of classrooms, whether we recognize them or not.
The American Revolution may have been launched by a specific group of elite white men for a specific purpose, but its rhetoric spread far beyond their intentions, inspiring agency and change among people they never considered. The Bray School story feels similar. It was created by a specific group for a specific aim. Yet once education spreads, like revolution, it can't be contained to the boundaries its founders imagined. Thanks so much to Nicole Brown for sharing her insights on today's episode. You can learn more about the Williamsburg Bray School through both the Bray School Lab and Colonial Williamsburg. Thanks for joining us on this bonus episode of Revolution Revisited.
Thanks for listening to Revolution Revisited. The American Revolution was not an ending, but a beginning. The stories continue to unfold. Subscribe now and catch the next episode for another journey through history. This podcast is made possible by William and Karen Fralin and presented by the Virginia Museum of History and Culture.
Revolution Revisited is a production of the Virginia Museum of History and Culture. Our production staff includes Haley Finner, Maggie Creech, Nicole Martirana, and Tracy Schneider. Be sure to subscribe to get notified about upcoming episodes. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time.
Open now at the Virginia Museum of History and Culture, Unbound. Free Black Virginians, an exhibition tracing the lives of free Black Virginians from 1619 to the end of slavery in 1865. Discover how these individuals claimed their freedom, built thriving communities, and navigated a society that called them free but not equal. Learn more and get tickets at virginiahistory.org.